Good afternoon, Jack Bangeter.
Good afternoon, Steel Wagstaff.
You know, Dave Jensen's on vacation. He left town. He took his brood of children with him, and so he will not be joining us today. But for you longtime listeners, you're getting an improvement, definitely an upgrade. The one, the only, the real-life Jack Bangeter is joining me today as my very special guest host.
Hey, thanks, man. That's quite a compliment. But I like Dave here, too.
Yeah, he's all right. It's in our contract that we have to have someone representing good weather. And we wanted the latest weather update from the West Coast. What are we looking at today?
It's 85 again, and sunny as always.
How's the surf?
Yeah, you could surf today, early November.
Oh, man. It's a paradise. It's the future. I need to move there.
Yeah, you should.
Well, hey, we've got 5 months of winter we're looking at where it's going to barely get above 35 degrees. I bet you can't compare with that.
No, I can't compare with that. That sounds kind of nice, too. I like a little bit of variety in my weather.
Yeah, it's nice. The crucial emphasis on a little bit of variety.
Yeah.
When you've got a lot bit of variety, it's kind of terrible.
Yeah.
Hey, well, Jack, I think we need to start with probably the most pressing news of the day. I know everybody in the media is obsessed with this presidential election. The most important news in world society today is the latest developments in sports hair. And I know you're a big fan going way back. So we need to start off right talking about sports hair. Jack, what was it that first got you into noticing and caring about sports hair?
I think, actually, it was Carlos Valderrama and his wild afro in the World Cup in the U.S. I guess that was 1994 or something.
Yeah.
92?
94. It was 94. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was kind of my first introduction into, like, paying attention to people's awesome sports hairdos.
Yeah. I think you were a pioneer in that, Jack. And I was going to say, my first recollection of sports hair was the 98 World Cup, watching it at your house and cheering for two teams. We were cheering for France a lot because of Zidane, but most importantly because of Petit, who had amazing hair. Emmanuel Petit had like the long Viking hair with the headband, I remember.
That's right.
But what I really remember is cheering for the Dutch. They had the awesome orange jerseys. And then they had Kluivert with his, like, high-top fade. Awesome. And Rijkaard had his, like, tiny dreadlocks. Ruud Gullit had some dreadlocks, I think.
Yeah, there were quite a few good hairdos, though they've kind of gotten crazier as time has gone out on. I think there's been an evolution in sports hair. Yeah.
It sports is a it's a golden age of barberdom, I think, is one of the things that we can really trace this to. Today's hairstylists and barbers have techniques and skills that the barbers of yesteryear could only dream about.
Yeah, speaking of barbers of yesteryear, I imagine or I wonder who did Andre Agassi's hair. That was always a good one. Do you think he went to a salon when he had that nice flowing mane?
I had to. Probably the guy who did Andre Agassi's hair is probably a millionaire today.
Yeah, that'd be sweet.
He's getting his designs displayed in MoMA.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, actually, Jack, to your point, I think, though, that there's probably been a trend in sports hair. As, I think, professional sports leagues, two things have happened. One, there's been, like, increasing corporate control of everything. Like, the players have to wear exactly the same jerseys. They have to be sponsored by a certain company. They also have to wear the same socks. They're, like, they're regulating every aspect of their appearance. Back in the 80s, like, Jim McMahon could take his big stand against the NFL by wearing his headband, but like he could never do that now. He'd get suspended or whatever. So I think as like their dress is getting more and more carefully regulated, the hair, it's the last frontier. It's the one place for artistic self-expression.
I agree. To me, at least, as far as this evolution goes, Dennis Rodman was kind of like a prime example of like early bold haircuts. If you look back at those wild colors and stuff he put on his hair, they look totally primitive compared to like today's wild haircuts.
Absolutely.
The colors and the whatever. But I like the kind of tie-dye effect that he's got going there in some of them.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a great point. I think he's probably a pioneer, a real sports hair pioneer. They don't look inventive now. It does look a bit primitive, but I remember the times. It's just a shock. And collecting sports cards, which we'll get to later, the Rodman cards. You'd be like, what hair is it going to have on the front? What hair is it going to have on the back? You know, it could be so many different things.
Yeah.
The other thing I think that's really happened with sports hair is massive TV exposure. So these guys know they're going to be broadcast on TV to thousands of countries, or not thousands of countries, but like, you know, millions of homes are going to see them. So there's such more high visibility. They want to vanity and they want to make TV deals and they want to stand out. So there's a bunch of peacocking that goes on that I think is related to like mass media exposure.
Yeah, I'm always impressed by the like players, especially in the World Cup, that like don't seem really quite as good or something, or, you know, they're not the top tier players and they're still rocking these really wild hairdos. And it's like, that's kind of bold, or I don't know. I guess I like that. Underdog. Yeah, like, I'm for the underdog.
He's like, I'm going to draw tons of attention to myself, not with my play, but my appearance. So you're going to remember me for being mediocre, but having great hair.
It's maybe how they made the team.
It could be. Coach is like, I just need somebody with a little more up top, some sports hair going on. Well, speaking of sports hair, we need to talk about favorites. NBA season's in swing, and I love what happens in the NBA. There's a bunch of variety, a lot of real beauty. But this year, a couple people upped the ante. I had a friend, Spencer, who sent me this big article about Michael Beasley just getting crazy designs carved into his hair, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. But the real mother load, I don't know if you saw this, Jack, the link to Gerald Green's hair.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking at it right now.
You got to pull it up. So Gerald Green was in the league like 10 years ago as a teenager playing for the Celtics. He's been floating around the league, played with many other teams, and this year he came back home to Boston. He's playing for the Celtics again, and for the first game of the season.
Whoa.
Yeah. What are you seeing?
Awesome. That's amazing.
Isn't it awesome? It's real art.
For those of you listening in, he's got an awesome, Clover, the Celtics logo.
The shamrock.
Braided into the top of his hair. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. That's impressive.
It's really intricate. It's beautiful. He didn't carve it in. He just braided the hair into the shape of a shamrock for the Celtics logo.
Yeah, it's braided in there.
It's innovative. It's attractive. It's impressive. And I think what's cool about it is it's non-destructive. You know, he didn't have to carve lines out and deal with the awkward stage of things growing back in. He just braided it in.
It's also a bit of a mix between something that's like drawing attention to himself and that it's also advertising the team. So maybe it's like the first team. Well, no, I don't know. I saw one that was like somebody had carved the Supersonics logo into the back of their head some years ago.
Would have been awesome, though, if he was playing for the Bulls and he was just pining for a trade. So he just carved in some other team's logo.
And Rodman had the Bulls haircut, too. So yes.
But it's one of the least narcissistic.
These have been a bit more like team oriented.
Yeah, I can live with that. It's less narcissistic, more socialist, you know?
Yeah.
The other thing that's kind of a common thing is the combination of like funky dyes and shaving various things. The kind of pioneers of this, I think, of in the soccer world, there was a guy, was his name like Gibril Cissé, the French striker? Used to always have weird, awesome hair, especially in the World Cup. And then the other guy that I remember being famous for this was the Cameroonian guy, Rigobert Song. He had his little goatee that dyed gold to look like a lion. It was amazing because the team, I think, were the Indomitable Lions.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that one, too.
Yeah. Real pioneers in the field. But you were saying when you look back at, like, luscious locks, incredible hair, you've also got a soccer example, maybe from 15 years ago?
Valderrama. So nothing better than a Valderrama afro.
That's an afro that could still be a Halloween costume today. I think it'd be still instantly recognizable to lots of people.
Well, here in LA, there are also lots of Colombians, so I think you'd totally get recognized.
Other favorite haircuts from soccer days of yore?
Well, soccer days of my. Once I had a my own sport haircut. Have you ever had a sport haircut?
Sport hair? Kind of.
You got tell a yours first, just then to I'll go tell play my... a sport.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I shaved with a razor all of my head except for a star on the top.
Nice.
And it was kind of buzzed, I don't know, a quarter of an inch or something. You could tell it was a star. And I went and played a soccer game. And then the next day or whatever, I had a sunburn in the shape of a star on my head. and I'd gotten rid of the star. So I definitely was like red and peeling all around a nice white star shape on top of my head. Pretty awesome. It impressed the girls in junior high, I'll tell you that.
I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
I think the initial like carving weird stuff in your hair, wasn't it like a Fat Ronaldo back in 2002 where he just left he shaved everything but left like a little bit at the front?
Yeah, that was a good one too. I think he did that too, or at least what I heard was so that his kids could recognize him on the TV. He was like, I'm going to cut my hair crazy so my kids can recognize me.
That's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah, if that's the real reason, it's the best haircut. I don't know. It's one of the better ones ever, I think. I like it.
Especially if we should add to this legend, I believe that his kids also administered the haircut, which makes it twice as good.
That could be too.
Yeah. the other favorite thing, so my sport haircut was actually, it was more of a tribute to Vanilla Ice that I did in high school, but I shaved steps, asymmetrical steps into one side of my head. So I had like three level steps. And it was awesome. During football season, so it wasn't very visible because you had a football helmet on. But I did leave it in as my hair grew.
Football players doing hairdos, though.
Yeah, it's like they do it all for themselves. It's for the glory of none. They really just put a helmet on it, but they can't even let their facial hair show.
Put a helmet on it.
Say that again.
Nothing.
If you like it, then you better put a helmet on it. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's safe sex tips from Jack Bangerter.
Little Beyonce.
Yeah. All right, the other thing that we need to talk about, Jack, and you'll appreciate this, is that there's a lot of ways that hair changes as people age. And many men have male pattern baldness or they get to go thinning on the top. And one of my favorite things is either people who are bald deniers that just keep the hair going or like keep their normal hairstyle, but it's clearly like thinning and balding, especially when they're high-level athletes. Because you think of like baldness as like, generally, we have cultural associations with aging and impotence and all that stuff. But, like, to think of baldness and, like, high-level athletic performance is one of my favorites. So let's talk about our favorite.
Well, I'm very familiar with the subject matter as a balding man myself.
Yeah.
So I also notice it. And I really appreciate people who are willing to go out there and just go bald.
Yeah. Michael Jordan, yeah. One of the originals.
Yeah, Michael Jordan. I was a little disappointed to hear that that LeBron is regaining some hair in some way. I was pretty excited to see him get a cool balding haircut.
Yeah, he definitely could. He definitely could do like the mid-40s dad hair if he wanted, but he's hanging on. I think the vanity, and he wears the headband pushed up real high on the forehead to make it look like he's got more hair.
Uh huh.
Yeah,
it's not fooling anyone.
No. Among my favorites, though, do you remember Chris Kaman? I think he used to play in L.A. for the Clippers.
I don't remember Chris Kaman, no.
He's like the 7-foot center from like Western Michigan, very kind of like trailer park chic. He used to long, stringy, like Undertaker-style hair and a real scraggly beard. But there was a year where he was balding pretty profoundly but left the long hair and terrible acne. It was among
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. You'd see him outside off the court, and you'd be like, this guy's trouble. But on the court, you're thinking, this guy's beautiful, you know?
Was he trouble on the court, too?
Yeah, he really was. He was awesome. the other two great haircuts come from soccer, the bald ones. Do you remember Gervinho, the guy from, he's from Ivory Coast? But he had these weird center braids, but he was also balding, so like he would part them in the middle, and his braids would start probably near the center of the top of his head. I don't know how high his hairline was, but I've never seen anything like it.
I wasn't ever sure if he was actually balding or if like that's kind of like a weird natural hairline for him or something. It seems like there's something a little bit weirder because I don't know where that balding hair would come from.
They literally look like curtains.
That's where I'm going bald.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he had, that's true. We'd have to see him without the braids, but they were like curtains. They really were, Jack.
Yeah, they were
the
like
Gervinho curtains.
They came down from the back of his head to like his cheeks.
They did. Yeah, basically. So that was an incredible hairstyle that I would love to be able to develop myself. But the one that I think that really takes the cake, you remember going to Boise High, having a chemistry class together with Mr. Garner.
Yes, I do remember Mr. Garner.
Yeah. Do you remember who else was in that class? A legend of hair?
A legend of hair in that class. Oh, I can't remember his name.
Do you remember what we'd call him?
unfortunately, yes, I do. We called him Tails.
And why? So why was he called Tails? Do you have any recollection of this?
Yeah, he had like a 3-foot rat tail braided on the back of his head. It was pretty impressive.
It was so. Hindsight 2020. The guy was brave. He was an innovator. He was a pioneer, and yet we ridiculed and mocked him.
Yeah, I don't even remember his name.
Tails. If I could do it over again, I'd have done a lot of things different, and one of them would be to show some proper respect for Tails. But the reason why I bring up Tails is because Tails has a high-level soccer equivalent. If anybody watched the World Cup this last time, they saw a super sub from Argentina, the great Rodrigo Palacio. Do you remember this guy, Jack?
I do. I mean, it was an instant classic as soon as the back of his head showed while he was waiting to go on the field.
Yeah, the first time I saw it, I was like, it's a mistake. I thought, what is it? There's something flopping around like a mosquito or something. Because he's just like a normal-looking, buzz-cut, kind of balding guy from the front and the sides. And then instantly when he turns back and turns his head quickly, you see this, like, very thin tail whipping around. And I was like, oh, I just don't have an HDTV. But no. I don't know how to describe it, Jack. How would you have described his appendage?
I don't know, like a leech, or I don't know. It looks like somebody just stuck something onto the back of his head. It's not in the center.
No,
it's like pretty well braided at the bottom, but like some of the hairs at the top, like where it's buzzed around, are just kind of like medium length and not in the braid. It's pretty wild one.
And it was maybe 2 feet long and very, very thin. I don't know, maybe the length of a headphone cord or the diameter of a headphone cord.
It was just, it was really skinny.
Yeah. And I never did hear a plausible or a good explanation. And most of the time, the TV announcers just pretended like he didn't have it. And I think it was a real lost opportunity to educate people on the greatness of sports hair from the last World Cup.
I wish they did like little exposés on the hairdos. But instead, they kind of tell some stories and stuff about the players' poverty and stuff from other countries and stuff. But we should focus on like more positive things next World Cup.
There's an off the chain suggestion for the next FIFA broadcast. We want more about sports hair, less about poverty.
Yeah.
All right. The next thing is on our docket today. We're going to talk about small talk. And for those of you who are longtime listeners, I'm sure you're grateful for this segment, but if people are new to the show, small talk is when we each share a story, anecdote, or something interesting that you can use in your next awkward conversation. Small talk's hard for a lot of people. So when you're at a party, we're going to keep you armed with a couple of things that you can just go to and just really wow people with your intelligence. Jack, what do you got for the listeners?
So this is a bit of a quick one, but it's one I use like all the time, and it is talking about one of my favorite products of all time, and that is the Cadet 3 toilet by American Standard.
Ah,
dude, this toilet, it'll flush 56 chicken nuggets, man. It is awesome.
That's all you need. You're done. You just walk out of the room, and everybody's like, "Who was that guy?"
I think that's what they say. I'm not sure that's the way that they say it.
So how did you come to know about the Cadet 3 by American Standard?
Well, I did my research when I was installing my own toilet in my house. I wanted, like, the best toilet. And not only is it, like, inexpensive or relatively inexpensive, it's not the cheapest toilet at your, like, local toilet shop, but it's not much more expensive than the cheapest one. So if you're looking for a toilet, this is advice you can give to people and when you're doing small talk. Yeah. Just tell them, if you're looking for a toilet, don't do anything but just go get a Cadet 3. It's the way to go.
I can't tell you how many times.
2 packs of cigarettes, 3 pounds of orange peels, 20 golf balls. Man, this thing will suck down anything. And it's a water preserver. It doesn't have like that much water in it. So it's like a good for the environment as well.
Wow. I'm sold. So the thing is, I can't tell you the number of times when I've been at a party, the conversation turns to toilets, to toilet-related topics, and all I've got is some, like, poop-related anecdote and story, and then I just kill the conversation. I want to be able to keep things flowing, as it were, and now the Cadet 3 is my new go-to. I really appreciate it, Jack, and I'm sure our listeners do, too.
Yeah. Good luck with that one, everybody.
Well, Jack, the thing that I want to talk about in small talk is actually something that I think you and I connected over recently. I read this website called The Public Domain Review, and they publish articles there about interesting stuff from the past that's now in the public domain. And one of the things, there's a woman who's an art historian who wrote a really interesting article about a history of visual representations of Barak, and it's B-U-R-A-Q. And for those people who aren't really big Muslim theologians, Barak is mentioned just very briefly in the Quran. The Prophet Muhammad, according to the tradition, he made a night journey from where he was living to Jerusalem and I think to heaven. So he steps on a rock in Jerusalem and they whisk him up to heaven. And the messenger, or not the messenger, but the
boat of transportation.
Thank you. Was a horse, a winged horse named Barak. So it's mentioned in the Quran. And the word Barak, I believe, has an etymological relation to lightning. So like this messenger from and to earth from heaven. And so Muslim artists have, over the centuries, tried to represent Barak in visual art to tell this story and to represent it. And it was just an incredible collection of really wild images. And I think it's a great conversation piece for parties or for storytelling. Just to tell the story of Barak, because not a lot of people have heard it, and it's kind of wild. And then to think about and share some of these images. I don't know what your impressions were.
Well, I don't suggest people like whip out their phone and share images when you're doing small talk. Maybe it's okay.
No, I don't know. Right. You're right about that.
I don't know the thing these days. But I think the story is cool, and both the story and the images inspired me when we were talking about it this before. Well, I also think it's interesting to talk about maybe the other winged horses or something, that this is like a...
Yeah, Pegasus.
Yeah, there's Pegasus, maybe dragons or something. I don't know. Where does the conversation go from there?
Yeah.
It can go anywhere. That's a good one, Steele.
Barak is a real conversation starter.
Yeah.
So there you go. And so, Jack, when you said it inspired you, how did it inspire you?
I did a watercolor painting of my dog as the winged horse Barak flying Muhammad to heaven. To meet God.
And this is one of the pieces that you're not going to sell.
I think it might be the only one that I've ever done that I want a memory of my dog when she goes. So yeah, I don't really collect my own artwork, but I have quite a bit of it. So I'm probably going to end up keeping a lot more than that.
But not by design.
Yeah, not by design. That's just one that I don't plan on selling. So
yeah, it's beautiful. So, if we'll put a picture up as maybe the cover image for this episode.
Okay, we can do that. Yeah.
Nice. Anything else that people should know for small talk, Jack?
I don't think so. Just be nice. Be nice to people when you're talking to them.
There you go. You heard it here first. Be nice, everybody. Well, the other thing that we were kind of touching on here, Jack, the thing that you brought up that we should discuss, this is kind of our main topic for today. We want to talk about collections and collectors. And it's kind of a baffling phenomenon. I don't know what brought this to your mind and why collections were interesting to you.
Well, I recently went to Utah, and I was hanging around for a month there, and I started collecting little rocks on my hikes and things around. And I found some really cool stuff, like dinosaur bone maybe, and petrified dinosaur feces, fossils and crystals and all these kinds of things. And then I just left them all there. Yeah, a collection that I didn't end up keeping, which so, I guess is similar to all of my collections personally. I don't have any collections anymore.
Yeah,
I used to have a lot.
I feel the same way. So where did collecting start for you? Because I used to collect tons of stuff, but I don't really now.
I don't know. I mean, to tell the truth, I think it was kind of part of my childhood from the very beginning was collecting. We had cards and Legos and just it was always stuff. And my mom had collections of stuff, you know? And we collected, like, dimes in a jar, and there's, like, collections everywhere in my life. I don't know. I think it overwhelmed me after a while.
Was it, like, borderline hoarding, or was it...
No. I think it was, like, I don't want to say they're like classy collections or something, but there's like they're like certain levels of things you can collect. They're like garbagey stuff,
schlock and trash,
schlock and trash. And then there's like my mom had like lots of sets of nice plates or something, you know.
Sure.
It's like middle class hoarding or something.
Proof of one's entry into the bourgeoisie.
Yeah. But anyway, now I find collections fascinating, but I don't participate, or I try not to participate. I think I don't like being a collector myself.
Yeah, I feel really similarly, because I used to collect tons of cards. Like, I was obsessive about them. I'd memorized statistics, had big collections of sports cards, and then I collected records for a while, and I collected old weird clothing, and I would wear it, and then I collected books, and there's a bunch of things that I've acquired that I've carted around with me, but as I've moved and as I've gotten older, like, gradually breaking up and giving collections away has felt really interesting and fun to me. But I also went to library school, so I studied, like, collecting and collections, and I'm still super interested in, like, these public collections or collections that are accessible to the public of the past. I'm fascinated by this stuff. I like describing things in them. I like visiting them. But I don't feel like I want to be the collector or the owner of things in the same way, or the proprietor of a collection quite the same way.
Well, I have a fascination with the libraries and museums for the same reason, I guess, is that they're like an external database for our brains and our houses, even. Like, I don't need to have the books. They've got them at the library.
Right. That's what my mom said when they got rid of almost their whole home library. And they still have books and they read and stuff, but they've outsourced their collecting to this public institution, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I also used to work at one of those institutions, at the Special Collections Department in the library at Northern Arizona University.
What were the things they collected there? What was the kind of cool stuff that you liked as part of their collection?
Well, their collection was stuff from the Colorado Plateau, like historical documents and from the Colorado Plateau, which is like a region in southern Utah and northern Arizona and Colorado. It's like high desert plateau. Hmm. I don't know. They had like some photographs of people in early days of the Grand Canyon and the journal of Zane Grey.
Oh, nice. My grandma loved him.
Yeah.
Or his books.
Lots of maps. Things like that. And now, actually, they have a copy of some videos that I made as a young artist that we called them Arbor Club. Just all the videos are Arbor Club, and we went around and planted trees illegally for different celebrities.
Wow, do you have copies of these videos? Could you link one for the podcast listeners?
I don't think I've got copies for them. I think like the only legitimate copies are actually in the special collections there.
We'll have to look up the finding aid and put a link for the hardcore.
Okay.
So here's my question, Jack, that I wanted to explore with you a little bit, because I'm thinking through it, and I don't know if I have a firm answer, but it's a curious one for me. Why do you feel like people collect stuff? What's the psychological motivation for collecting? I know they're various, but...
I mean, I've been explaining that I'm not much of a fan anymore. To me now, it sort of seems like a disease of some kind.
Yeah? Like a pathology?
Yeah, I would say that, like, capitalism is the cause of it. Like, people feeling like they need to have things and keep things around and, yeah,
some
like
kind
stuff.
Of consumer envy. Yeah,
consumer is something.
I was thinking about this as well. Like, my first question was wondering, like, are collections always tied to one's nostalgia for childhood? It seems to me that adults, so many people as adults, collect things that have a really deep connection to their childhood. Like, they collect often children's objects or children's toys. Those are the most commonly collected themes, it seems to me, like cards and coins and trains and dolls. And, like, many of them seem to me to be, like, infused with a profound nostalgia. Like, we want to master or own this thing that has gone from us, that's departed, that we really want to get back. We want to recover it. I want to recover that feeling of childhood in my own childhood, and I want to also possess it and return to it in terms of mastery. And I don't know if that feels like a convincing explanation or if that feels like it rings true at all.
Clearly that rings true in many situations. I think those might be the situations that we like see in the public, because they're like, it is kind of cool when somebody has like 10,000 Barbie dolls or something, you know? But I think that there are also like, yeah, I don't know, other other types of collections. I mean, you have like real hoarders who are collecting things. It's like the total opposite end of hoarding there. And I think that there's probably a really real variety in between. There are people that collect like movies, pamphlets, and I don't know.
Yeah. I think about even the history of museums, though, and the beginning with the Cabinet of Curiosities, you know, that people used to collect. To make in the 1700s, 1800s, and it was in many ways like a symbolic display of the collector's intelligence or their power or their wealth or their good taste or either bad taste, whatever the case may be. And then I also feel that for many people there's like a psychological need to fill a void somehow. I was reading somebody describing that it's a void in the sense of self sometimes, where the collection is an attempt to like shore up the self. To become, this collection is like an extension of you, and you achieve some kind of immortality through it because it's past-oriented and you're preserving these dead things or these objects without a context anymore, and by doing it, it gives you a permanent context. Or just to be the best at something, to be this distinctive, like, oh, I may be ordinary in every other respect, but I have 20,000 bottle caps and they're organized by color.
Yeah. That'd be awesome.
You know?
Yeah.
It's something to give you meaning, and it also sets you apart. It makes you unique.
Yeah, I think that sounds, at least to me, more convincing than that it's, like, always tied to, like, a desire to be a child or, like, to get back to that time.
Huh. So what about some cool collections, either in your life or people, or, like, the collections that impress you or that seem interesting to you?
Well, just talking now, I was reminded of what I maybe think is the most interesting collection of things that I've ever seen, which was a museum in Groningen, the Netherlands, that was a collection of like pieces of body parts that this guy had collected. It was like an anatomy collection. And there was a time when like this was a popular thing to do. And so there were just all kinds of body parts and in jars and in display cases and little dancing baby skeletons holding flowers. Lots of like beauty was like added to these things to like make
aestheticize the corpse of
something. there was a baby's arm in the glass bottle with a little doily at the bottom, and then the hand was holding a feather. Quite wild. And there were tattoos that had been cut off people, and penises and vaginas in jars, and everything you can imagine. Lots of like skulls from all different like parts of the world, so you get like the variety of skull shapes from different regions and stuff like that. Really wild.
Well, you know, have you been to the Museum of Jurassic Technology there in L.A., Jack?
You know, I've still not yet been. I'm embarrassed to say.
Okay. Well, that's on your to-do list for the coming year. And I haven't been either, but I've read a book about it, and Laurel's sister used to work there. And that seems to me, in many respects, like a kind of a place where these strange collections get merged with thinking about collections, because they're sort of fake collections, but also merged with real things. It's this real blurring of what's real and what isn't in a very smart, eccentric kind of way.
That's what I hear about it also. I'll have to go check it out for myself. I haven't heard anybody disappointed with seeing it, though.
That's the crucial thing.
That's the thing, yeah.
So what did you collect as a kid?
Oh, man, tons and tons of things. Marbles and sports cards and whatever. But I think my favorite personal collection was what I called the Museum of Stolen Items. And this was
when was this museum collection. Active?
This was a collection of items taken from hotel rooms. So it's like just the free bottles of shampoo and free soaps and shower caps and a razor. I've probably got a few of those, or had a few. I don't still have the Museum of Stolen Item collection. But my aunt, who worked at a museum, had the museum shop print me up a museum sign, you know, one of these plastic ones, really nice lettering, and it said the Museum of Stolen Items. So I had that for my collection.
That's awesome.
And then
that's really great.
Go to hotels and stuff. They'd collect their things and bring them back, and I had quite a collection of shampoos and soaps and whatever.
Was it on display in your apartment or in your home, or where was the sign and the stuff?
It was like in a box under my bed.
Oh, okay.
And the box was on top of the sign was on top. I didn't have it displayed. It's kind of like too much garbagey stuff. Like all collections, I think.
My dad was a mild coin collector when I was a kid, and so I started with a coin collection. And then when he was in the Air Force, he would travel around the world, and so he'd bring back currency from around the world. And that part, that's a collection that actually seems quite interesting to me as a collection type. In part because coins have like a social value, you can buy things with them. But even less so because there's a real cultural variety. Like a coin is generally the same size, roughly, or shape. But what's printed on them and the colors and the materials that are used in currency really do vary. And they are pretty reflective of cultural values and of what a place in a society values. I don't know. I think that coin collecting can tell you a lot about a place.
Yeah, I think that's a good one. I mean, I don't mean to like totally be bad mouthing collections. Like I say, I love to go see other people's collections, but I don't particularly want one anymore. Though I've had some currency from other places too, and I do enjoy looking at that.
Your mom's a famous collector. You mentioned her a little bit here. We got to give a shout out to Heidi. What's she well known for as a collector?
I don't know. She's collected all kinds of stuff, too. Like I said, she had some plate collections. One time when we were cleaning out her house, we found all of these Hallmark bells that like had, or I don't know if they were Hallmark, but some kind of like little porcelain bells that had the year stamped on them. They were like New Year's gifts or something that you gave to people.
Wow.
We were cleaning out her attic. And I found these and she was like, oh, you know, I've been saving those for like 20 years. I think maybe they're like worth something. And so I looked them up on eBay and they were like $1.83 each. So I don't know if you're collecting something because you think it might be worth something later. I would say that's like a really bad collecting idea.
Collection as investment. Although, Jack, your livelihood does depend a bit on that.
It does. The people that I expect to collect it in that way, though, are like wealthy enough that they don't really care.
They're not going to retire on their art collection. They're going to retire and have an
art collection. not on my piece of their art collection anyway. So to the rest of you, if you're interested in buying my artwork, don't do it as an investment. I hope to make it worth more as time goes on, but it's really just a thing for you to like.
Yeah, there we go. Okay. I want to say one of my favorite collections. I love that this subculture exists. Sneakerheads. Is that a phrase that's meaningful to you, Jack?
Yes. I've heard about this anyway. I'm fascinated by the idea of it, but I have so many questions about why.
Yeah. That's a good question. We should do a psychological profile of a sneaker collector. But we're talking about sports hair. The other place that there's real variety that we forgot to mention in the modern athlete is through the sneakers. And this is a much more commodified instance in the hair because you don't usually have brands associated with haircuts, but you definitely do with sneakers. Although there's incredible variety of really interesting design and sneakers really signify and symbolize a lot. And there's a bunch of very hardcore sneaker collectors.
So the thing about sneaker collecting for me that's questionable is, well, I don't know. I answered it just myself a moment ago. It's about that you like these things because once you wear the sneakers, doesn't that decrease the value of them like immediately?
I'm not sure whether the real collectors buy them and never wear them or whether they buy them and wear them occasionally, like they wear it once a year and then they polish them with their toothbrush and just keep them in pristine shape. I don't know.
Uh-huh. I don't know either.
We need to get a sneakerhead on. That's on the bucket list for Off the Chain.
Okay. I'll keep my eyes out for one.
The other thing, Jack, though, I associate you with collecting are records. And this began, I think, probably when we were in high school together. We used to be go to thrift stores like on a weekly basis. I used to buy really ugly clothing, and I would also buy like cheap books, classic literature, and records. And you bought many of the same things, but had a very particular eye for the records you were looking for. And I don't know if you recall this the same way, but...
I don't know. Was I just looking for babes on the records? I know there was one particular record that I collected quite a few of, which was the Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass Whipped Cream and Other Delights album.
Yeah. Taw, I remember.
That's what we named the woman on the cover?
I think so. But so there was a gorgeous, mostly nude woman with whipped cream in strategic places on the cover of this Herb Alpert record. And every time we saw it, we would buy it. And I think all of our friends eventually knew that you were collecting this record because didn't you put them up in your room somehow? You decorated your room?
I had them going all the way around the top of my room like a border. I must have had 40 or 50 of them or something.
What we'd started with was just the Herb Alpert, the Tijuana Brass. Which one was that record? Whipped Cream and Other Delights. But then we would just buy any Herb Alpert record. And so you probably
had 40
or 50.
Oh, that's right. There were some other, there were some others, too. Yeah, they all have beautiful women on them as well.
Often they did. So my question, though, is did you ever listen to any of those records? Do you know what Herb Alpert's music sounds like?
A little bit. I mean, I played them a bit. And you hear it, you hear Herb Alpert playing on the radio or whatever every once in a while. And now he's like an artist, a sculptor.
It all started with whipped cream, man. Trying to recapture his glory days.
That's right. Yeah, I wonder if he sculpted that whipped cream. It kind of looks like his other sculptures too, the piles of whipped cream.
It's not bad work if you can get it, I guess.
Yeah.
So did you ever know, Jack, who the woman was, or was it just this object of desire? Do we have a story for her?
You know, I looked her up a while ago, but I can't remember. Maybe I heard she died or something, but now that's like I'm going to say that and it's not true.
Well, neither is anything we say on this podcast. We don't have a little facticity rating.
Just don't fact check that.
No.
Actually, do fact check that. Somebody
Listeners,
listening.
Tell us
check
who's on
the
cover.
And you'll want to learn about her, too, when you see her.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's a great memory of collections. I don't know. The other thing that I think you're notorious for collecting over the college years, you built up a very impressive collection, which you actually gave to me, which I still have, Jack. It's the only part of my record collection I still have.
Wow.
And we'll talk about that here in a second. It's a nice segue, but it was Donovan Records. I don't know how many you had and how you came about them, but that's a story worth telling.
Yeah, I had tons of Donovan albums. Well, I worked at a used bookstore. And they took in records. So anytime albums came in, I'd take a look at them and kind of had first pick out of sort of before the customers sometimes, I guess.
It's the perk of working there. That's why I wanted to work at a thrift store for years and years.
Mm-hmm. I think the used bookstore is a little bit better as far as getting some quality stuff coming in.
You're probably right.
And the smell of the used bookstore was better than what I remember the thrift stores being most of the time.
Less urine?
A little bit.
Yeah. All right.
But I did. I had maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 Donovan albums.
That might
of which
be a conservative
I get
estimate.
Quite a chunk, I think.
Yeah. Those were real classics. I think we had almost everything he released in the U.S.
Including a few British ones. Did I give you the one with Me, Me, I Love You on it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I still have it.
I got that on my birthday. That came into to the bookstore, and I bought it, and I went home, and I dropped the needle on that album, and just as I did that, the postman knocked at the door, and delivered me, on my birthday, a signed copy of Donovan's album or book of poetry, and it reads inside, "Happy Birthday, Jack," from Donovan.
Whoa!
Yeah,
talk
my
about
brother.
The universe.
Yeah, it was awesome. And I just have to tell one more quick Donovan story. This year on my birthday, Donovan was showing up at LA City Hall to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Sunshine Superman.
Wow.
And I went and saw him at City Hall, shook his hand.
Man.
It's awesome.
Brush
my
with
birthday
fame.
Donovan.
And, you know, the picture you posted, Jack, I was surprised because Donovan's like 4 feet tall. He's a leprechaun.
He is. Yeah, he is kind of a leprechaun. He's not he's not a massive man.
He's got a gentle heart, a peace-loving soul.
Yeah, he was totally peaceful. He was awesome.
I love it. So, Jack, it's time for us to do Unchained Melodies. The longtime listeners know this is where we play a couple of songs on a theme. And as you can imagine, the theme today is musicians that we have collected. And I think it's only right, Jack.
Should we kick it off with some Donovan?
I think it's only proper. What do you want us to play?
Let's do some Ricky Ticky Tavi by Donovan.
Better get into what you got to get into. United Nations ain't really united, and the organization ain't really organized. Ricky ticky ticky, mongoose is gone. Ricky ticky ticky, mongoose is gone. Won't be coming around for to peel your snake no more, my love. Ricky ticky ticky, mongoose is gone. Everybody who read the Jungle Book and know Ricky ticky ticky is a mongoose who kills snakes. When I was a young man, I was led to believe...
Your organization is to kill my snakes for me. I.e. the church, i.e. government, i.e. schools.
Yeah, break it down, Donovan. Take care of yourself, man.
What a libertarian, that Donovan. So, Jack, terrific song, the YouTube upload that you noticed.
You didn't play that from the YouTube, did you?
No, I didn't. It might have been a different version. That was the single version. But
yeah. The YouTube upload said, quote, "If you like hippie shit, maybe this song be for you," or something like that.
They got straight to the point, and they were not wrong. They were not wrong. All right, Jack.
And we like hippie shit.
We really do. When we were in high school, my favorite musician was Beck, and that was probably the person I collected most avidly. Every time a new record came out, I'd go to the record store on the day of. I would buy it. I was also always looking for imports. I'd buy singles, and there was a time when I joined one of those online pirate communities where they would like share Beck bootlegs. And so somewhere on a hard drive, I have probably 50 gigabytes of FLAC files, like high quality audio files of live Beck shows over the course of like 10 years or something.
Awesome. Do you think you can even play those files anymore?
Yeah, if you'd have to use like Winamp or whatever we used to use back in the day. Those are the days. but what I'm going to play actually is from the Loser single. There was two songs, and I'm going to need your help, Jack, just based on the title. Two songs from the B-side of the Loser single. The first choice is Corvette Bummer, and the second choice is Fume.
Corvette Bummer sounds awesome. Okay. After all, people collect Corvettes, right?
There you go. You know, I could never understand why that wasn't a big platinum single.
Yeah.
Corvette Bummer.
Yeah. Most of Beck's early work was pretty just nonsensical lyrics. Is that the...
Yeah, pretty much like just stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
Half rapping with like weird kind of early 90s beats under it.
Sweet one, dude.
Thanks. That's Corvette Bummer, the B-side from Loser.
Yeah, sweet one, Beck. Nice B-side.
All right, Jack, I think we know where we're going to go next, but we want to hear a little taste of South of the
taste
Border
of
sound.
Let's do a little Love Potion number 9 from Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
I'm ready.
From, of course, the Whipped Cream and Other Delights album. You may have heard this in your local supermarket. Or JCPenney.
Thank you.
poaching in the name.
Really, just stellar musicianship throughout that record. It's just a classic for the ages.
I imagine those guys were really grooving when they were playing these tracks.
Yeah, I just think to be a fly on the wall in that studio, Jack, those were the days. Okay, so I'm kind of torn about what to play here. I don't know what the – I mean, I would say my equivalent of your Donovan through much of my high school and college years was Cat Stevens. I collected a ton of Cat Stevens, and that came from my parents. My parents, my mom and dad, both gave me a few records at the start of my record collection, and they had a bunch of Cat Stevens records, and that's where I probably learned Cat Stevens. And my dad likes ballad songs, like songs, songwriter songs that tell a story and are kind of wimpy. So Cat Stevens has got a million of those. There's a birthday party at my house, and my mom said, oh, I'm going to rent a movie for Steel and Jack to watch. We're going to have pizza. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I do.
She's like, oh, cool. The cover says it's got Cat Stevens songs on it. They're like this. And she looked at the back. She's like, oh, it's just PG. I bet it'll be fine. And so she rented, and it was Harold and Maude.
Classic film.
Classic film. But you can imagine, like, my mom is watching it with this and going, what? What did I do? What? They're, like, making a suicide pact, and there's this intergenerational love couple. It was a classic. It was like proto-Wes Anderson movie, and my mom's mind was blown. She was not ready for this and for her teenage son and his friend to be watching this under her advisement.
I guess she enjoyed the music.
Yeah. If you want to sing out, sing out. Great song was on that film. But instead, actually, although I've talked about Cat Stevens, the guy I want to play, actually, is Greg Brown. Do you know Greg Brown, Jack?
No, I don't know. And you have to tell me about your collection of Greg Brown as well.
Okay. So this probably started around the same time, a little after. I went to a family reunion in Utah, and my cousin Ricky, who was at the time like a music reviewer in the Bay Area for a newspaper, and he told me, he said, Steele, I know you like folk music and you like good stuff. You got to check out this guy, Greg Brown. He's amazing. And I'm like, I've never heard of him. So we go out to his car, and he had a CD player in his car. This is probably like 97, 98, so it's pretty advanced, you know. And he puts in this record, and it's a live record, a live album with Greg Brown. And he's this guy from southern Iowa. He's a folk singer, deep baritone voice, beautiful songs. And he plays this like 13-minute song called Canned Goods. And in the middle of the song, he starts telling these stories, and he starts talking about Pablo Neruda and poetry and chickens, and it's amazing. And he tells this, like, he's just this great storyteller, singer, and I was blown away. I hadn't really ever heard something like it, and I really liked it. So I went back, and I eventually got that record and got a bunch of other records, and all through college, I just listened to Greg Brown a ton. And I think I was probably one of the only 20-year-olds in the U.S. that, like, was interested in Greg Brown. He's like old man folk music, basically. But he's a musician that I have fond feelings for from that time in my life, and it's even now. And so I was gonna play a little bit from that Canned Goods song by Greg Brown's live record here that my cousin Ricky introduced me to. I should say Greg Brown also used to always be on Garrison Keillor. He'd go on several times and sing songs and perform. That's the kind of guy he was.
I've probably heard him.
The wild winter wind blow and blow, I'll be as warm as a July tomato. Peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bin, supper ready, everybody come on in. Taste a little of the summer, taste a little of the summer, taste a little of the summer, my grandma put it all in. There's a root cellar, fruit cellar down below. You better watch your head now. Down you go, peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bin. Supper ready, everybody, come on in and taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer, taste a little of the summer. My grandma put it all in jars. Oh, Or maybe you're world weary and you don't give a damn. I bet you never tasted a blackberry jam. Pizzas on the shelf, potatoes in the band. Supper ready, everybody. Come on and taste a little of the summer.
Maybe I'll try to jump ahead and see if I can get to him talking here.
Woman, she come out of that house doing a jig with this rag thing she wore in her head flying back in the wind and her flippity-floppity egg-gathering shoes would be flippity-flopping. You knew it was the holidays. I felt so good. I'd always try and get out of the car and give her a hug and a kiss and get out of there before the ants came out of the house. But I don't think I even made it one time. Here would come the ants. I don't know. It was an amazing, awesome thing to watch, all these ants come out of that little house. It was a little tiny, low built to the ground, little Southern Iowa house. No, just that root cellar, no basement or anything. Foundation was like, well, try some of that. Little low built to the ground house. But here come all these ants tumbling out of there. It's like watching people come out of a Volkswagen or a phone booth or something. It just didn't seem possible. All these big bucks and big hips, strapping Southern Iowa women coming out of that house. Yeah, they came, the uncles, they never hardly made it out once. I don't know, they were smothered or something, I don't know. All these big buxom, strapping, strong Southern Iowa women were all married to these little tiny, tiny, skinny guys. That was just the, that was the cool couple down there. The uncles never made it out, but here would come the ants, and I'd try and give my grandma a hug and a kiss and get away before the ants got there, but they always got me. Usually Aunt Virgie would get me first. So big woman, she'd grab me and pull me right down in between there. Bam!
That's the flavor of it, man. There's 13-something minutes of that song, and that was the beginning of a collection for me and a kind of a long-time love affair with Greg Brown.
Sweet. I think that sounds like pretty nice music to listen to have going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just put on the background, think about life and love and sadness and all those kinds of things. So, very Midwestern and storyteller, for sure. Well, Jack, I think we need to end with book wisdom. And book wisdom here is also somebody that you used to collect. Tell us who you're going to share and why.
Well, I used to collect Richard Brautigan books. And just books, I guess. Books of poetry and novels.
Most of our listeners probably have no idea who that is.
Yeah, he's kind of like a hippie beat writer from California in the, I guess, the 50s and 60s, 70s? 70s, maybe even into. Must have gone into the 70s. Maybe even in the 80s. I don't know. Anyway, I really like Richard Brautigan's crazy writing style. And also the covers on his books are awesome. He's always got these black and white photos. Sometimes he's like wearing this cool hat, looks like Mark Twain or something.
Yeah. What a guy. I mean, he died before he was 50.
Yeah.
I don't know the whole story, but I had never heard of him until you shared a book with me, and I read several of his books, and they were just like nothing else I'd read before or since, really.
They are like nothing else I've read before or since. As I was researching a little bit, I was less excited than I remember being about his writing when I was younger. And kind of collecting things. It took me a while, but I found something that I thought was like substantial enough to have as book wisdom here on the show. And it's still a timely piece of poetry, perhaps. It's called "All Watched Over by Machines of Love and Grace."
And now I've... Yeah, and is this a poem, or does it come from a book, or what's the source of this?
It's a poem, and I'm not sure which collection of poetry it's from. He's got like,
Gift of a
I don't know, probably 80% of his work is poetry. But I think people kind of know the short stories and essays kind of stuff better. Okay, here we go. "All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. I like to think, and the sooner the better, of a cybernetic meadow where mammals and computers live together in mutually programming harmony, like pure water touching clear sky. I like to think, right now, please, of a cybernetic forest filled with pines and electronics where deer stroll peacefully past computers as if they were flowers with spinning blossoms. I like to think, it has to be, of a cybernetic ecology where we are free of our labors and joined back to nature, returned to our mammal brothers and sisters, and all watched over by machines of loving grace."
Oh, It's hard to tell whether he's serious or joking, as in, like, all of his poems and his writing, but...
I like the idea of machines of loving grace, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I really think we should just make robots to do all the crap.
Yeah. You know, here's a story about this book, Jack, that I remember, and I actually read about it a little bit in my library class and brought it up once and when we were studying copyright. It was unique because when he published this book, I think it was in late 60s, he included a statement in the book that says, I'm retaining copyright, but he gave people permission to reprint any of the poems in the book, provided that they gave them away for free.
Oh, that's very cool.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so totally late 60s California, but it's also really lovely. So that poem's been reprinted tons and tons of times.
Cool. It's a good one, too. Yeah. So,
all watched over by machines of loving grace. May that be all of our destiny. May you all be watched over by loving, graceful machines.
Like the one you're looking at right now.
Like, exactly. Jack, buddy, it was a pleasure. The time just flew by.
Yeah, thanks, Steele. It's been fun again.
It has. Off the chain. The record spent 141 weeks on the top 40 albums chart, and Herb Alpert used to tell audiences, sorry, but I can't play the cover for you. Dolores Erickson, the Seattle Times, 2012, said, she is now 76 and living in Longview.
How's she looking at 76?
Wrinkly. I don't take any pills, she says. She has a message for all those boys, now all grown up. Enjoy the view.